Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. On today's program, our guest is Stephen Wunker, founder of New Markets Advisors. He has degrees from Princeton, Columbia, and Harvard Business School. He helped build the innovation strategy firm Innosight into the dominant player that it is now in the field. He's developed strategies for organizations such as CellPay, Bain & Company, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and the United Nations. He's frequently published in Forbes and Business Week, and he's been interviewed by the New York Times. He's also appeared on the BBC. Currently, he's the visiting executive at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. He's author of the new book, Capturing New Markets. Stephen, welcome to Edgewise.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Stephen, in your book, you point out that 42 of America's 50 largest companies are based on exploiting markets that were new.
You bet. This is how great companies get started. Now, some of the companies on that Fortune 50 list have been around for a long time, but if you dig into how they took root and started growing explosively, it was through capturing new markets. Exxon, for instance, was behind the commercialization of kerosene and then gasoline, and then more recently has invented a huge host of petrochemicals. They even helped invent the lithium battery. Johnson & Johnson invented the Band-Aid, the suture, the stent, disposable contact lenses. And then more recently, of course, you have companies like Apple and Google, which are serial innovators, and a lot of their growth as well comes from pioneering market after market.
Now, you mentioned in your book that there have been ideas that have often gone neglected. As a matter of fact, the first steam engine...
That's right. In the first century AD, a man named Hero of Alexandria, who is this brilliant innovator, invented the steam engine. His idea was totally workable, but it lay in a sketchbook unused because there wasn't a network of fellow innovators to help improve on it. And there also wasn't an immediate commercial application. The economy of Roman Egypt was based on slave labor. They didn't really need a labor-saving device. It wasn't until the 1700s when Thomas Newcomen invented an improved steam engine for the coal mines that it really started to take root. And then over the next 50 years, the technology got good enough to become the workhorse of the Industrial Revolution.
Okay, now what kind of events trigger market formation?
There are several things to look out for. Certainly one of those is a new platform technology like the steam engine or the integrated circuit or the internet. The fascinating thing about platform technologies is that they typically lead to new platforms. Things get used in totally unexpected ways. When Newcomen invented the steam engine to pump water from the coal mines, he didn't have in mind a railroad, but the railroad was utterly transformative, and then that in turn led to a lot of other innovations. The integrated circuit underlay the cell phone, which underlies operating systems like Android, which underlie hundreds of thousands of applications, new ways that people can interact with the world while they're mobile that the founders of the integrated circuit never had in mind.
So if a new platform is created and it's something that might relate to your business, it's very good for you to start pursuing the likelihood of an opportunity coming from that.
That's right. It pays to think ahead about new platforms, whether they're business models or channel partners or technologies. What sort of opportunities does that open up? And not just what sort of threats does that pose? A lot of people, when the internet came around, saw it as a threat. You could have a lot of direct commerce, but there are some companies that exploited it tremendously effectively to create totally new sales channels and interaction with the customer that solidified a relationship rather than left it open to this hyper-competitive marketplace online. But it's not just about technology, and this is a really important point about new markets. It's not just for technologically based companies. It's also about the business model. Sometimes there is a realignment of either regulation or business partner incentives that opens up new market space.
Okay, but can you explain this concept to us?
Let's take an example. The American drugstore giant Walgreens has become the leader in workplace-based health clinics. Yes, those use internet connectivity and email, but we all do these days. It's not a technology-based business. What they've realized is that with employers' healthcare budgets at the breaking point, they're looking for very cost-effective ways to bring primary healthcare to their workers, and in particular to address the chronic diseases that are driving a lot of healthcare expense and which really just need consistent follow-up on behavior change and lifestyle modification in addition to rigorously taking drugs. So workplace clinics are a great way to do that, and Walgreens has an advantage through having its retail pharmacies that it can direct people to places to go outside of work hours and also direct people's dependents to go to those clinics as well. In doing so, it is bypassing a lot of the middlemen that have historically been in the U.S. healthcare industry. It's contracting directly with employers, and it's improving the quality of healthcare as well.
Now, in the book, you also mentioned that being a second person in the market, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
It really depends on the industry. There are countless examples of people with a great idea who were just too early or got it wrong. Friendster had this terrific social networking business, but got completely eclipsed by Facebook. There are three basic tests if you think you're going to be first in the marketplace. First, are there barriers that you can put up that are sustainable against competitors coming in? Secondly, by being early, are you risking getting locked in to a technology or business model or business partners that might be detrimental if the market evolves in some unexpected directions? And then thirdly, are you incurring a huge cost by being early because you have to pioneer a technology or educate the marketplace? Some companies can successfully answer those questions. Zipcar, for instance, was one of the first companies to rent cars by the hour, and now they've built this insurmountable lead. Hertz has its Me Too competition, but everybody's going to call it a Me Too competitor because that's what it is, and they don't really have an advantage against Zipcar, which has established this really strong position. But in other industries, look at Samsung coming very late to the cell phone market, but because they've had some other advantages, for instance, they're a leader in display technology, they're a leader in microprocessors, and they were able to leverage the channel of cell phone operators to gain visibility for their innovations. Now they're the number two global player, even though they were a late entrant. So it depends on the marketplace. Facebook was not even second or third. But they had a different take on where the market was. They focused first on colleges. They had a very tight niche focus, and they grew in that niche. They were extraordinarily effective, and then they expanded out from that. You can't rely on just novelty pushing you forward if you're not the first in the marketplace. But you can succeed if you have a niche or if you have another set of assets. Take Microsoft with Excel, far from the first spreadsheet program. But because it was the first on Windows and it integrated so effectively with other Windows applications, they've become overwhelmingly the dominant spreadsheet program in the marketplace. Or Visa, also far from the first credit card. That was Diners Club 15 years before Visa came onto the market. But Visa had a very different strategy. They worked through banks. And because banks had a totally different sales channel capability, they were able to grow what was initially Bank AmeriCard into the predominant force in credit cards it is today.
Okay, it seems to me that today, coming out of the recession, companies are still hesitant to get into new markets. So do you have any other examples?
It would be easy to talk about a company like Google or Apple, but let's talk about Nintendo. Nintendo was far from the first video game company to the marketplace. Even before Atari, there was Magnavox with a system called Odyssey. They weren't able to get traction because they had the wrong sales channel. They were selling it through TV dealers. Then you had Atari, which had a lot of first mover advantages, but had an improper business model in that they didn't control the distribution of games. And so there got to be a lot of bad games, and they didn't invest appropriately in follow-ons to their blockbuster 2600 system. And so you had Nintendo there, who was able to exploit the weaknesses of people like Atari, but also able to exploit their own strengths. They were a leader in arcade-based games. They concentrated first on bringing those games over to home play. So they started where they were strong, and they started small, but it took root. And then they looked at portable video gaming, which was a totally new market. It was an opportunity to target not Sony or Sega or some of the other rivals, but it was a way to target non-consumption, which is a wonderful competitive set to go against because you're competing against nothing. And then as the market matured, they didn't have the capital to compete against Sony and Microsoft with Xbox in this arms race that those two companies were undertaking with these hyper-powered computers. The processing power in a PlayStation 3 is equivalent to what a supercomputer was only a few years before that. So Nintendo competed in a totally different direction by inventing the Nintendo Wii, looking at a totally untapped market, people who were lapsed gamers, people who may have had that Atari 2600 a long time ago, but had given it up because games had gotten so complicated. They decided rather than having the best graphics and the most complex games, they were going to have the most simple games at a price that was a lot more affordable than Xbox or PlayStation, and incidentally at a much higher margin than Sony or Microsoft was able to earn. So each time they looked at a non-consuming marketplace and they competed very asymmetrically, leveraging the few advantages that they had, but in a way that created totally new market space. They started with the consumer and worked backwards, looking at latent need rather than addressing the market as it was today, the biggest, most profitable customers, those hardcore gamers that Microsoft and Sony were so focused on.
Now, can you gauge early on the dollar potential of the market? Can you measure that?
You have to be realistic about what you can measure and not. Sometimes you just have to ask yourself, what's the important question? So I remember in 1997, I had a client ask me, how big is the internet going to be? We had no idea. The internet was just taking root. That was the wrong question. The right question is it big enough to matter in my business? And the answer there was unequivocally yes. Sometimes you can actually gauge the rough potential of a market, even though the market doesn't exist. So for instance, think about a medical device company with some sort of revolutionary new technology. They may not be able to estimate what their sales are going to be, but you can say, well, how many people are suffering from the condition that this technology treats? What is the cost imposed on health insurers by this condition? How much can we potentially save for health insurers? How competitive do we think this market is going to be? So how much ability do we have to capture the value that we're creating? And then you can work backwards to a reasonable range of estimates about, is the market big enough to be worth pursuing?
Can you give us an example of that?
You could take robotic surgery as a good example of the importance of remaining flexible. Initially, Intuitive Surgical, which is the company that pioneered the Da Vinci robot, which is overwhelmingly predominant in the robotic surgery market today, targeted cardiac surgery. One mistake they made in doing that is that the bar for efficacy in cardiac surgery is really high. You can't mess up in cardiac surgery. So although the overall market looked very big and very attractive, it was too hard a nut to crack. And they ended up going for prostate cancer surgery instead, where it could be a very useful adjunct to existing methods. And eventually it took over in that foothold, not because it was a huge foothold, but because there were certain features of anatomy that made robotic surgery extremely attractive there. Then Intuitive Surgical was able to educate this whole generation of surgeons about the other benefits of the robot, that it's not just about precise cutting, but it's about 3D visualization and a lot of other wonderful things that the robot provides. And now it's expanding to other medical indications as well.
And what exactly does that suggest?
The moral of that story is when you choose your first market, don't go for those biggest, most profitable customers. That's what you would do in an established market. But in a new market, that is often just too high a bar to cross. Instead, go for a foothold that's going to take up that innovation readily and provide you with data about how this innovation performs in real life, create reference customers, and educate a bunch of customers about the value of your innovation. Then it's going to be a whole lot easier to penetrate those bigger, more profitable customers over time.
Does that also provide a little bit of a defense maneuver to keep other companies from coming in?
This varies between markets, but if you look at medical technology, for instance, the best defense a company can have is clinical data about outcomes, and that just takes a long time to create. In some other markets, it's about scale. John D. Rockefeller was able to clean up with Standard Oil because he built scale. And he would go to his competitors and open up his books and show them the economics he had in the refining business and say, well, I can undercut you any day of the week. So why don't you just sell out to me and then I'll have some more scale rather than you fight this battle, which you are destined to lose. In the case of social networking, it's about the size of the network. Facebook was able to create a 600 million member network, just an insurmountable lead for any rival to try to surmount.
What about sales channels? Does that impact this as well?
Sales channels are less considered than they should be by entrepreneurs or people who are behind a new market. They get enamored of the full potential of the idea, and they neglect the fact that sales channels often don't really care about new markets. They don't care about innovations because it doesn't meet this quarter's quota. Sales channels are notoriously short-term oriented. And in the short term, it takes a lot of effort to educate a customer base about something new. There's a risk that something might go wrong, and the payoff is likely to be fairly limited in the near term. Sales channels ultimately can be a hugely impactful way to get an innovation out there into the marketplace. But in the short term, they can be detrimental. What a company often needs to do is sell direct to its first customers. That's also a great way to learn firsthand about what the marketplace really demands and iterate your offering quickly. Then, as time goes by, you need to nurture the sales channel so that they can be brought on board. It's a tough balancing act because you need to give them a commission, sometimes when they're not doing a whole lot of work, but ultimately, they're the ones who are going to fuel the eventual rapid ascent of an industry.
What about government policy? Does that impact going in, finding market, and trying to maximize it?
It sure can. If you look at energy today, a lot of the renewable energy industry is fundamentally based on government policy, whether it's government mandates or subsidies. Too often, people are hoping that government is going to intervene and create a market. And certainly in today's world where governments don't have a lot of excess money to spend, that can be a futile hope. Rather, there are some things that government can do which are dirt cheap. They're apolitical and extremely effective.
Mm-hmm. For instance?
Setting standards and allowing for more open competition based on standards that also facilitates take-up of an innovation. So government can play a role that is not terribly glamorous, but it's incredibly important. It's sort of like road building. Government lays the groundwork and they set some basic traffic laws. They publish data about traffic accidents and even sometimes the location of traffic. So they create a smooth functioning market, but they are not the market. They are a facilitator of the market. It's a really subtle but important difference for government policymakers to have in mind.
Very interesting. But can you give us an example?
Let's take the cell phone market. In mobile telecommunications, Europe created a standard called GSM, which was this humongous success, and it really turbocharged the ascent of the mobile industry in Europe, which was about 5 years ahead of the United States for many years. The United States, by contrast, had a let a thousand flowers bloom philosophy, which ended up just confusing the market and prevented things, for instance, like text messaging from taking off. You couldn't send a text message from one network to another network because they were on incompatible standards.
What about companies either abroad or U.S. companies going abroad, finding possibilities of a market there? What would you advise?
If you look at emerging markets, clearly there is a huge opportunity to create new markets in countries like India and China, which have 40% of the world's population. And even today, penetration of those countries in total sales for the S&P 500 is around 10%. It's a very small number. But those are very tough markets to crack. And if you look at extremely well-managed global enterprises like Ford or Vodafone, they've struggled to create viable businesses there. So while it's important to think about India and China, maybe make some tentative steps there, there are some mid-sized countries which are a lot easier as places to do business and where you can learn a lot about what consumers in a developing economy might really want. Mexico, South Africa are great springboards for expansion. Walmart's most successful venture for quite some time in emerging markets was in Mexico, where they templated a business which certainly needed a bit of adaptation, but not as much adaptation as in other emerging markets. You find South African companies now leading the charge up Africa into sub-Saharan Africa and becoming huge giants in those economies based upon their experience in their home market.
What's the most common question you get asked by companies trying to do the right thing?
A question I get a lot is, where do you start? Clearly, there is a strategic necessity to tackle new markets, but it's hard, particularly if you're an established company with a lot of other things cooking. The first piece of advice I have is you start now. There's always a reason to postpone. Sales are too weak, or they're too strong, or customers are too concentrated, they're too diffuse. There are always good reasons not to do something. But there's never going to be that magical time when new markets are the thing to tackle. There's never going to be a time when the pace of change slows down and you get a breather where you can tackle new markets. You have to start right away, and you have to start in a strategic manner by thinking about where is the latent need, starting from the customers, working backwards into where markets might blossom, not where they are today. Think about a portfolio. There aren't any venture capital firms, certainly not ones that survive, that only have one investment. This is risky stuff. Inherently, if you don't know where the market is going to head, you are going to be prone to failure. Venture capital firms fail a lot more than your average Fortune 500 company, but they also have much better returns on investment. The secret to managing that conundrum is that they fail very fast and very cheaply. So the flip side of having a good strategy is having a good process. You can iterate very quickly, double down on the bets that are working, and cut your losses fast.
And I would assume that this same approach can be applied to startups, to mid-sized companies. Just because you're not Ford doesn't mean you can't capture a new market.
Absolutely. And in some ways, this is easier the smaller you are. Big companies have a lot of internal process to work through. Some do it quite effectively. Startups on the other end of the spectrum just don't have the flexibility to have a portfolio of investments. They have to choose because they don't have the resources. Sometimes those choices work, but sometimes you just can't iterate rapidly enough because the money and the people aren't there. A mid-sized company is in a nice position of having some resources, but not having as much bureaucracy and not having this fire hose of attention and money directed at new market ventures. That can often be a lot more harmful than it is helpful. Effectively creating and capturing new markets should not be expensive. The more money you layer into things, the less flexibility you have to iterate things fast. A mid-sized firm can still be close to customers. It can still have a lot of competitive advantages, yet be faster to iterate its way in the marketplace.
We've been speaking to Stephen Wunker, author of the new book, Capturing New Markets. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today on Edgewise.
Thanks very much, Dave.
AMA webinars provide 90 minutes of focused how-to instruction and specific solutions for solving your most pressing work issues. For $149, you'll participate in an in-depth course taught by an expert who will answer your questions and guide you through the process a step at a time. For a complete schedule of upcoming AMA webinars, visit our events calendar at amanet.org/events. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.